and the patriarch Sergius. The details of the siege are preserved in a sermon preached afterwards by the clergyman Theodore the Synchilus. On the first day of the attack, the city was completely surrounded, and all of the buildings outside the walls were set on fire, ringing Constantinople with flame. Siege engines and catapults were moved into place, while archers kept up a hail of arrows over the city wall. The Avar and Slav troops, numbering at least 80,000, stretched as far as the eye could see. The firm ground and the sea were both full of wild people, Theodore says. While the official, Bonus, organized the city's garrison for defense, the patriarch Sergius began holding regular sermons, vigils, services, and sacred processions. He was determined to remind the people that they were suffering through a war of religion. Liturgy was said almost without pause in the Hagia Sophia, and the entire city was seized with a fervor that would have carried the people through a much longer siege. On the 10th day of the siege, the general in charge of the Persian attack sent his entire fleet into the strait. His plan was for the Avars and Slavs to occupy the garrison so that his ships could approach by water without meeting much opposition. But the Byzantine navy proved much stronger than he expected. The ships from Constantinople drove back the Persian fleet, sinking ships and drowning their crews. One could have said that all the bay could have been passed with dry feet because of all the corpses lying there, says Theodore. With the attack from the east over, the garrison could concentrate on beating off the Avar and Slav assault from the west. Thousands of Avars and Slavs fell, until the allies began to retreat in disorder and chaos. The siege had failed. The Persians withdrew in disgrace. The Persian commander was forced to evacuate Constantinople and retreat back into Syria. Heraclius, still far away, took immediate steps to strengthen the Byzantine position. Since he had lost the Avars and the Slavs as allies, he sent ambassadors north to yet another nomadic tribe. Like the Avars, these nomads had been driven west to the Byzantine borders by the Turks, and they had made a home for themselves in the mountains north of the Black Sea. Heraclius knew them as the Khazars. His embassy to them is their first appearance in recorded history. The Khazars agreed to join the fight. Together, the Khazar warriors and Heraclius's army began to fight their way south into Persian territory, pushing down between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea into land that Khosrow II had laid claim to. The Khazars sacked the city of Derbent, while Heraclius continued on towards Nineveh. By 628, the Byzantine army, without the Khazars, who had remained closer to their homes in the north, had reached the walls of Ctesiphon itself. The defenders of Ctesiphon did not have a patriarch to unify them in religious fervour. Instead, they turned on Khosrow II. He tried to flee, but his own son and his courtiers caught him and crucified him, an end of agony and humiliation for a king who had lost all standing in the eyes of the people. His son took the throne in 628 as Khavad II, and immediately sent to Heraclius, offering to make peace. The treaty that followed gave back to Heraclius all the land that Khosrow II had conquered. It also returned to Heraclius the fragment of the true cross the Persians had taken from Jerusalem. Heraclius proceeded from Ctesiphon to Jerusalem in triumph, and on March 21st of 630, he returned the true cross to the city with his own hands. The war was over, and the landscape had changed. Byzantium had regained its old shape again, but the Persian Empire had been reduced to a weak and uncertain kingdom under shifting leadership. Khavad II ruled for a matter of weeks before dying of unknown causes, and for the next 4 years, a whole series of transient rulers, pretenders, and usurpers passed through the Persian palace, none of them reigning for more than a few months at a time. North of the Black Sea, the Khazars had expanded into a political force to be reckoned with. The Avars, weakened by the defeat at Constantinople, lost more land to the Slavic kingdom of Samo, and their threat began to fade. The Bulgars, north of the Azov Sea, had been under the Avar thumb, but now their chief, a young man named Kubrat, sent a message directly to Heraclius, asking to negotiate with the emperor as an independent sovereign. Heraclius agreed to recognize Kubrat's kingship, and from 632 on, the Bulgarian chief reigned as king of the first Bulgarian kingdom, Old Great Bulgaria. Heraclius, returning to Constantinople in victory, had saved the empire. He had broken the Persian threat, he had almost single-handedly created two new nations, he had restored the cross. Khosrow II had died in shame, but Heraclius was exalted to the skies as almost divine. In 6 years, the emperor had overthrown Persia, writes Theophanes, and in the seventh he returned to Constantinople with great joy. God, who had made every created thing in 6 days, named the seventh day that of rest. And so Heraclius, who had completed many labors in 6 years, returned with peace and joy in the seventh year, and rested. Heraclius had accomplished everything he could have dreamed of, and in doing so he had destroyed every barrier that lay between his empire and the Arabs to the south. Chapter 37. The Prophet. Between 590 and 622, the Prophet Muhammad forms a community and rules over the city where it gathers. Below the desert that separated them from the titanic struggles to the north, the tribes of South Arabia carried on the daily battle of surviving in a dry and hostile land. Himyar, on the southwest corner of the peninsula, was technically under Persian rule, but for most of Arabia, Persian ambitions and Byzantine crusades were irrelevant. They fought with each other and with the elements. In 590, a disaster far to the south shifted and broke the existing patterns of alliance and hostility. In the center of Himyar, near the city of Marib, a man-made dam had been built back in the days of the Sabian kingdom. The dam closed off the Wadi Dana, the valley that collected rainwater and runoff from nearby mountains during wet seasons, usually only April and a 30-day period in July and August. Author's note, a wadi is a valley whose floor becomes a river or stream during times of rain. The dam allowed the residents of Marib to save water and channel it through an irrigation system connected to the valley into cultivated fields. Thanks to the Marib Dam, the population of the city had been able to grow to around 50,000. Large cities were rare in Arabia. There was simply not enough food and water to support big and permanent gatherings of population in one place. Marib was the exception. Unpredictable shifts in weather patterns during the 530s and 540s had twice caused such severe and sudden rainstorms that the dam, unable to hold the runoff, had broken. Both times, the flood caused enormous damage. The mass of water gushed out and came down, and there was great terror, wrote Simeon of Beth Arsham, who chronicled the history of Himyar under Persian government. Many villages, people and cattle were flooded, as well as everything which was standing in the way of the sudden mass of water. It destroyed many communities. The dam had been repaired twice, but the entire system had been badly weakened, and in 590 the dam gave way for a third time. This time, the flood was catastrophic. Villages downstream from the dam were wiped out for good. Marib, already shrunken from its former size after the previous breaches, was almost deserted. Tribes from the south, who had relied on the water, migrated towards the more welcoming oases along the northeast of the peninsula. The moment of the dam's collapse remained in their memory, and the years before the flood became mythically glorious, the height of southern Arabian civilization. The final breach of the dam was remembered as the moment when the glory ended. Just as the great flood of the ancient Near East echoed into the book of Genesis, so did the breach of the Marib Dam echo into the Quran. There was for Sabia aforetime a sign in their homeland, two gardens to the right and the left. Eat of the sustenance provided by your Lord, and be grateful to him, a territory fair and happy, and a Lord oft forgiving. But they turned away from Allah, and we sent against them the flood released from the dams, and we converted their two garden rows into gardens producing bitter fruit. We made them as a tale that is told, and we dispersed them all in scattered fragments. Author's note, the Quran uses both first-person singular and first-person plural pronouns for Allah. This does not imply plurality. The Arabic form, like the archaic royal we in English, conveys authority and command, and is sometimes called the plural of majesty. Some Arabic dialects also mix the first-person singular and first-person plural in colloquial conversation. The dispersal northwards meant that Mecca, the home of the sacred Kaaba, was no longer the only largest city where tribes gathered. Mecca did benefit from the migration. It sat on a trade route, and now it had little competition farther south. But tradition holds that many of the southern refugees ended up in the city of Medina, a sprawling settlement with fertile ground to the north. Medina was less prosperous than Mecca, but it had its own importance. It was a mixed town, made up of Jews who had migrated into Arabia long before, and native Arabs, and intermarriage had tended to blunt the racial distinction between the two groups. The influx of peoples northward intensified the stresses in these towns. The Arabs of Mecca, like those in other Arab towns, were first and foremost members of clans, Banu, linked together by blood and marriage, and the clans themselves were loosely associated into larger groups, or tribes. Mecca was governed by a council made up of the patriarchs of the most powerful clans. Among these were the clans of the Banu Hashim, the Banu Taim, and the Banu Maksum, all of them belonging to the Quraysh tribe. The Quraysh tribe was dominant in Mecca, and its clan members controlled the Mecca council. But all was not well. Quraysh dominance was resented by other tribes. In fact, the Quraysh had been forced to fight a bloody war with the Qays tribe just 4 years before the Marib Dam broke to keep their power in the city. It was called the Sacrilegious War because it was fought during a sacred month. Control of Mecca and its resources had been deemed more important than worship. Author's note: the Arabic tribes were supposed to observe 4 sacred months per year, the 11th, Dhu al-Qida, 12th, Dhu al-Hijjah, and 1st, Muharram, in succession, providing a 3-month break from fighting, and the 7th, Rajab. Since the old Arabic calendar was lunar, these months moved from year to year, and the tribal chiefs were fairly casual about delaying the beginning of the sacred times if they weren't quite finished with an ongoing war. And hostility between the clans of the Quraysh itself was growing more severe. The style of government that had served the Arabs for centuries had been developed in nomadic times, when the cooperation of the clans was necessary for the survival of the tribe. In the old, dry desert days, war between clans could mean extinction for everyone. They all shared the common goal of finding food, finding water, and staying alive. Now, in a Mecca growing ever more wealthy, the clans were no longer forced into cooperation. Instead, they were competing for the riches of Mecca, and some clans were doing much better than others. Personal fortunes were on the rise. Widows and orphans, deprived of their family support, were pushed aside. A strong king might have solved some of the knotty problems caused by this government of equals, but the Arabs were constitutionally anti-king. They had spent too many centuries relying on each other to put all of their trust in any single man. The clan of Banu Hashim was one of the poorer and more resentful clans, and it was into the Banu Hashim that the child Muhammad was born. Author's note: for simplicity, I will refer to the Prophet Muhammad as Muhammad throughout, although this was not his birth name. His father died 6 months before his birth. When he was 6 years old, his mother, too, died, leaving him a full orphan. His grandfather died 2 years later, and Muhammad was raised by his uncle Abu Talib, an ambitious man who had fought for the Quraysh in the sacrilegious war, and who did not rate his nephew's comfort among his personal priorities. Muhammad grew up on the edge of survival, earning his keep by accompanying his uncle's merchant caravans on their journeys to other cities. At 25, he agreed to a profit-sharing venture, leading a caravan for another Quraysh merchant, a widow named Khadija, who could not take on the task herself. The first caravan he supervised went all the way to Syria, and Muhammad's management was so expert that he doubled the widow's investment. According to Muhammad's 8th-century biographer, Ishaq, when he came back to Mecca with the money, Khadija saw an opportunity. She proposed marriage, and he accepted. Khadija was 40 years old, 15 years Muhammad's senior, but she would bear him 3 children, and Muhammad, somewhat against custom, did not take any other wives during her lifetime. Author's note: Ishaq lists 7 children, but it is likely, given Khadija's age, that 4 of these were either orphans raised by Khadija or children from one of her 2 previous marriages. The wealth from Khadija's caravans put Muhammad and his new family in the upper crust of Meccan society, but he seems to have been continually disturbed by the growing distance between rich and poor in his city and the rampant materialism of his tribesmen. 10 years after his marriage, he took part in the rebuilding of the wall around the sacred Kaaba, necessary because men had stolen part of the treasure. Even the shrine was not exempt from greed. Muhammad, devout by nature, took it upon himself to spend 1 sacred month of each year providing for the poor. His biographer Ishaq tells us that he would pray, give food to all the poverty-stricken residents of Mecca who came to him, and then walk around the Kaaba 7 times. In 610, while observing his month of service, Muhammad was given a vision of the angel Gabriel. His own account of it was preserved in oral tradition and passed down to Ishaq, who set it down exactly as he heard it. He came to me while I was asleep, with a coverlet of brocade, whereon there was some writing, and said, "Read." I said, "What shall I read?" He pressed me with it so tightly that I thought it was death. Then he let me go and said, "Read." I said, "What shall I read?" He pressed me with it again so that I thought it was death. Then he let me go and said, "Read." I said, "What shall I read?" He pressed me with it the third time, so that I thought it was death, and said, "Read." I said, "What then shall I read?" And this I said only to deliver myself from him, lest he should do the same to me again. So I read it, and he departed from me. And I awoke from my sleep, and it was as though these words were written on my heart. The next day he again saw the angel and received the rest of the vision. He was the prophet of God, appointed to take the messages of the angel to the rest of his people. It is no mistake that the account does not say exactly what the words are. For the rest of his life, Muhammad would struggle to receive and interpret, and then to pass on, the revelations of God. In 610, when his first vision took place, he was given only the seeds of the religion that he would ultimately found. And those seeds were simple. He was to worship the one God, the Creator Allah, a deity already known to Arabs, and he was to pursue personal purity, piety, and morality, all of which were already prescribed by Arab sacred practice. The word that he would use for righteous behavior, al-ma'ruf, means that which is known. The problem with Meccan society was not a lack of revelation. It was a lack of goodness, the unwillingness to follow what the tribesmen must already have known, as Muhammad did, to be right. For 3 years after the vision, Muhammad told only his family and immediate friends of his call. His first followers were his wife, Khadija, a servant named Zaid, taken captive in a tribal battle, who had married and stayed with the clan and fathered 4 daughters, all of whom also became followers. His cousin Ali, son of the uncle who had raised him, and his close friend Abu Bakr. Not until 613 did he begin to preach his message to the rest of Mecca. By this point, it had taken a more distinct shape. After an agonizing silence during which he doubted the reality of his vision, the revelations had returned, and the most basic divine truths had become clear. "The guardian Lord has not forsaken you, nor is he displeased. The hereafter will be better for you than the present. Did he not find you an orphan and give you shelter? And he found you wandering and he gave you guidance. And he found you in need and made you independent. Therefore, treat not the orphan with harshness, nor turn back the beggar unheard. But the bounty of the Lord rehearse and proclaim." The core of the message was simple. Worship Allah, care for the orphan, give to the poor, and share the wealth that had been divinely granted. At the root of Muhammad's teachings lay always the memory of the orphan he had been. When he began to proclaim this in public, Muhammad collected more and more followers, primarily the weak, the poor, and the disinherited. The message did not go over as well with the newly prosperous upper classes of Mecca. The clan leaders of the Quraysh complained that Muhammad was insulting them and mocking their way of life. "Either you must stop him," they warned his uncle Abu Talib, "or you must let us get at him, for you yourself are in the same position as we are, in opposition to him, and we will rid you of him." To his credit, Abu Talib refused to turn against his own family, even to protect his wealth. The other clan leaders, seeing the spectre of a gathering revolt of the underclass behind the charismatic and popular Muhammad, began a campaign of terror against any clan member who accepted Muhammad's message. His followers were attacked in the alleyways of Mecca, imprisoned on false charges, refused food and drink, pushed outside the city walls. Some of the new converts, afraid for their lives, fled across the Red Sea into the Christian kingdom of Aksum, where they were welcomed by the Aksumite king Arma as worshippers of one God. Others went farther north to Medina. The members of Muhammad's clan, the Banu Hashim, who remained in Mecca, were forced into a ghetto, and a ban was declared on them. No one could trade with them, which cut off their food and water. In these wretched conditions, both Muhammad's wife Khadija and his uncle Abu Talib grew ill and died. And it was in these wretched conditions that Muhammad was given a new revelation. God permitted those who were wronged and driven from their homes to fight back. Outside of Mecca, it was slightly easier to be known as a follower of Muhammad. The tribes of Medina were looking for a solution to the unrest and intertribal warfare in their own city. Having heard Muhammad's message from refugees who had fled Mecca for the more welcoming streets of Medina, A delegation came to visit the prophet and listen to what he had to say. Some were converted. Muhammad called these converts Ansar, helpers, a name that was often given afterwards to the followers of Allah who were not from the city of Mecca and not part of Muhammad's own tribe. Muhammad, who believed that he had not yet been given divine permission to leave the city of his birth, remained in Mecca long after almost all of his followers had fled. Their departure put him in a much more dangerous position. He had little support left in the city, and the revelation allowing his followers to fight back against their oppressors had made the clan leaders of the Quraysh more suspicious of him than before. When the Quraysh saw that the Prophet had a party and companions not of their tribe and outside their territory, Ishaq writes, they feared that the Prophet might join them, since they knew he had decided to fight them. So the Quraysh planned that one representative of each clan would join in a group assassination of Muhammad. That way, no single family would bear responsibility for his death. It was then, Ishaq concludes, that God gave permission to his prophet to migrate. Only Muhammad's cousin Ali and his old friend Abu Bakr were left with him in Mecca. Under cover of dark, Abu Bakr and Muhammad climbed out of the back window of Abu Bakr's house, which was being watched, and made for Medina, while Ali stayed behind to make sure that all the prophet's debts were settled. The day of his flight, the Hijrah, was September 24th, 622. Afterwards, all dates for the followers of Muhammad, now known as Muslims, were counted as A.H., after the Hijrah. The Hijrah was the first day of the first year of a new way of reckoning. This, not the date of Muhammad's first vision, was the point at which Muslims reckoned that their identity began. It was only when Muhammad came to Medina that he was able to begin to shape his followers into something new. Like Constantine, he had discovered a bond that could hold together a group of Arabs who did not naturally count themselves as members of one clan, or one city, or one nation. This bond of belief, belief in the one Creator, commitment to a life of justice and purity in his name, had created a new kind of tribe. All those who followed the words of Muhammad were Ummah, one community to the exclusion of all men. The Ummah were by far the most powerful group in Medina, and as their leader, Muhammad was the de facto ruler of the city. But not all of the residents of Medina were members of the Ummah. Some of the Arabs and all of the Jews held themselves apart. One of Muhammad's first concerns was to protect their rights. He did not want to recreate the stratified system of his home city, with members of one tribe dominating the interests of others. He began to speak revelations to this problem. All men and women in Medina had equal rights, whether or not they worshipped Allah. Almost from the point of his arrival in Medina, Muhammad took on the role not just of prophet to the believers, but as a civil authority over the unbelievers. Medina, like Mecca, was torn by conflict between clans and tribes. Unlike Mecca, it was not controlled by a powerful cabal able to unite itself, when necessary, against a threat to its interests. Muhammad offered the city a path towards peace, and it was accepted. He began to achieve political power, not through conquest, but through his reputation for wisdom. From its very beginnings, Islam was unlike Christianity in this way. The followers of Jesus, not to mention the disciples of Paul and the early bishops, had no cities of their own. They had no kingdom. Christianity became a religion of empires only when Constantine brought it into Rome with him, across the Milvian Bridge. And between Jesus and Constantine lay several centuries of belief and practice, theology and tradition, war and conquest. But Muhammad had a city. From the day of the Hijrah onward, his revelations governing the purity of worship and the morality of the believer were mixed with his need to make civil legislation for Medina. From the very beginning, his teachings were affected by his need to establish a political order. The man who had lost his father and mother, his family, his wife, and finally his home, had found a new family among the community of his followers. His greatest concern was to keep those followers together in one body, united with each other and with him in loyalty and oneness of purpose, and for that he needed not just the judge's balance scale, but also the sword of justice. Chapter 38. Tang Dominance. Between 622 and 676, the Tang Empire of China battles with Tibet and the Turks and tries to take over the kingdom of Silla, while the Yamato dynasty of Japan joins in the resistance. By 622, the new emperor of China, Tang Gaozu, had signed a peace with Goguryeo, bringing an end to the long bloody conflict started by the Sui, and had begun the task of refilling the imperial treasury, emptied by war and canal building. Despite the frequent outbreaks of minor rebellion in the unsettled country, the Tang dynasty was finding its way carefully forward into stability. The dynasty's biggest problem came from the Turks to the north. After the death of the Turkish Khan Bumin Khan, founder of the Turkish kingdom, Turkish unity had fractured from the inside, and the kingdom had fallen apart into separate realms, the Eastern Khaganate and the Western Khaganate. The Eastern Khaganate was closest to the Tang border, and for a time Tang Gaozu managed to stay on reasonably good terms with the Khagan. Gaozu's own family was not so very different in custom and language than the Turks. He had grown up in the northern reaches of China, where the Turks and Chinese mingled along the border. Gaozu's mother and grandmother had been of nomadic blood, and Gaozu himself had raised his sons as hunters and warriors, more interested in horses and hunting dogs than in Confucian classics. But then the aggressive Khan Hsieh Li took control of the Eastern Khaganate. In the decades before Hsieh Li, the Eastern Turks had attacked the border on average about once every 3 years. Under Hsieh Li's rule, the Turks began to raid the northern Chinese lands once every 2 or 3 months. In 624, the army of the Eastern Khaganate marched all the way down to the Yellow River and then crossed it. The Tang troops panicked. Only the intervention of Li Shimin, the emperor's second son, kept them from bolting. Li Shimin rode out and offered to challenge Hsieh Li to single combat, something no southern Chinese prince would ever have done, which struck the Turkish Khan as the act of a man confident of victory. The Khan began to suspect that his own men were in league with Li Shimin, and that the duel was a trap. He refused to fight, and instead accepted another huge payment and withdrew. Tang Gaozu, the dynasty's patriarch and founder, did not reign for much longer. He had served as the bringer of judgment on the previous dynasty's excesses, but this role was not naturally compatible with a long and virtuous rule as holder of the Mandate of Heaven. Instead, his son, Li Shimin, would take on this job, ruling for over 20 years and bringing the Tang dynasty into full legitimacy. Li Shimin had fought for his father in the wars that brought Tang Gaozu to the throne, and had earned a loyal following of his own through his bravery against the Turks. In 626, he murdered, possibly in self-defense, his older brother, the crown prince of the new dynasty, and asked his father to appoint him heir instead. Tang Gaozu agreed. A few months later, he abdicated and gave his son the throne. Li Shimin became Tang Taizong, the second emperor of the dynasty. Like his father, he had come to power through violence, but the force was partly veiled by his father's decision to pass him the crown without struggle. As soon as he was acclaimed emperor, the Eastern Turks invaded again. Again, Li Shimin, now Tang Taizong, put his own body on the line. "The Turks think that because we have had internal troubles, we cannot muster an army," he told his advisers. "If I were to close the city, the capital, Chang'an, they would loot our territory. I will go out alone to show them that there is nothing to fear, and make a show of force to make them know I mean fighting." In fact, the Tang troops at Chang'an were too few to defeat the Turks, but Tang Taizong rode out with 6 men to the Wei River, just north of the city anyway, and reproached Hsieh Li for breaking their earlier peace. Meanwhile, his army assembled far enough away to make them difficult to count, but close enough for Hsieh Li to see them. Tang Taizong, exercising his knowledge of northern customs, then offered to go through a brotherhood ceremony with the Turkish Khan, and Hsieh Li accepted. The Turks went home, but Tang Taizong exercised his new brotherhood by doing his best to encourage Hsieh Li's subjects to revolt against him. This was not so different from his relationship to his own brothers, 2 of whom he had killed on his way to the throne. He also encouraged Hsieh Li's nephew to lead a coup d'état. Civil war between uncle and nephew began in 629. The Tang armies marched up to help, and by 630, Tang Taizong had driven Hsieh Li into exile, accepted his nephew's surrender, and named himself Heavenly Khan of the Eastern Turks, as well as Tang Emperor. The Tang Empire had suddenly expanded, and Tang Taizong, once again showing his familiarity with northern affairs, managed to make himself popular with his new subjects by making tribal leaders into Tang court officials. For the next 2 decades, Tang Taizong led his kingdom into internal stability and outward conquest. Rather than making any great new innovations, he turned out to be expert at developing the network of government already traced out by the Sui. And he led his armies in expanding his control over the north, the northwest, where he conquered the eastern reaches of the western Turkish Khaganate with the help of his new eastern Turkish subjects, and the southwest. His trust was placed not in scholars, but in men who, like himself, knew the northern methods of fighting. Throughout his life, wrote the poet Li Bai of the Tang soldiers, the man of the marches never so much as opens a book, but he can hunt, he is skillful, strong, and bold. In the southwest, the Tang generals encountered another empire builder, but unlike Tang Taizong, who was building an empire on someone else's foundation, this king had laid his own groundwork. His name was Song Tsen Gampo, and he lived on the high Central Asian land known as the Tibetan Plateau. The Tibetan tribes had come, thousands of years before, from the same area as the Chinese, but continued in a nomadic lifestyle long after the Chinese had started on the road to farming and town building. Song Tsen Gampo's father, Namri Song Tsen, was the leader of one of the Tibetan tribes. He had taken the first tentative steps towards dominating the neighboring tribes when he died, sometime between 618 and 620, and his son, perhaps 14 at the time, inherited his title. Like Clovis of the Franks to the west or Bumin Khan of the Turks up in the Altay Mountains, Song Tsen Gampo began to work at the task of turning a collection of tribes into a kingdom. And like most tribal leaders turned king, he chose outward conquest as a way to make his new territory cohere. After 620, he brought the nearby tribes under his authority, and then launched campaigns against the Tuyu Hun nomads around Lake Kokonor to the northeast, possibly as a way to distract the other tribal chiefs from the unpleasant fact that they were now under his domination. He sent armies west toward India and east toward the Tang border, but his mind was not only on conquest, he also worked at making alliances with his neighbors, establishing for the first time a Tibetan foreign policy. In 640, he sent an ambassador to the Tang court with a message. He wanted to make a marriage alliance with the ruling family. Tang Taizong was unimpressed. In Tibet, Song Tsen Gampo was a prodigy, a superstar statesman able to take his people from disorganized tribal structure to empire in less than a generation. In the universe of the Tang, he was merely a barbarian king with pretensions. The Tang emperor refused to send a princess to the west, and Song Tsen Gampo immediately invaded the southwestern territory of the Tang, the area now known as Sichuan. The Tang defensive garrisons managed to drive him back out, but Tang Taizong was surprised by the strength of the attack and decided that it would be prudent to rethink. He sent one of his nieces, Wen Cheng, westward to the court of Song Tsen Gampo, and in 641 the two were married. Wen Cheng seems to have brought with her Buddhist monks, Buddhist scriptures, and the Chinese habits of eating butter and cheese, drinking tea and wine, and consulting the stars. She was followed westward in time by experts she asked the Tang court to send, Chinese craftsmen who could teach the Tibetans how to make wine and paper, how to cultivate silkworms and build mills to grind grain, how to treat patients according to Chinese medical principles. Chinese culture, northern Chinese culture, infiltrated Song Tsen Gampo's empire. So did Indian ways. Wen Cheng also suggested that her husband send one of his officials into northern India to bring back principles of written Sanskrit. The Tibetans had had no written language, but by the end of Song Tsen Gampo's reign, a Tibetan script based on Sanskrit was in use. Song Tsen Gampo died in 650, after building an entire nation in a single lifetime. Like so many empires built on personal charisma, the Tibetan kingdom began to waver. His heir was his infant grandson, Mangson Mangtsen, and the real power of the palace was the baby's regent, the prime minister, Gar Tongtsen. For a time, the empire halted its expansion and its foreign embassies, absorbed instead with an internal struggle for power and familiar conflicts between Buddhist worshippers and followers of the old nomadic religions. Within months of Song Tsen Gampo's death, Tang Taizong also died. His throne went to a grown heir, his favorite son, Gao Zong, who had been at his deathbed fasting and weeping and was rewarded with the crown. In the year he was acclaimed emperor, Tang Gao Zong also added a new wife to the consorts he already had. He rescued one of his own father's concubines, Wu Zetian, from the Buddhist monastery where she had been sent after Taizong's death. Apparently the two had been sleeping together for some time. In 656, over the protests of his courtiers, the emperor demoted his first wife and made Wu Zetian empress, naming her three-year-old son crown prince. In the first years of his rule, Tang conquests continued. The western Turkish Khaganate had suffered a civil war between rival leaders, and in 657, the Tang armies marched through it, surprising the battling Khans. The general in charge of the western front, Su Dingfang, rounded up his troops in a blizzard and sent them in for attack through 2 feet of snow. "The fog shreds darkness everywhere," he told them. "The wind is icy. The barbarians do not believe that we can campaign at this season. Let us hasten to surprise them." The unprepared soldiers of the Western Turks were defeated, the land of the Khaganate reduced to a Tang protectorate. Now the Tang Empire stretched all the way to the borders of Persia, but on the cusp of a domination unlike any before, the Emperor Tang Gaozong fell ill. Contemporary accounts tell us that he suffered from devastating headaches and dizziness and lost his eyesight for a time. He had probably suffered a stroke, and in his weakness he relied on the intelligent and well-educated Wu Zetian, asking her to read him state papers and authorizing her to make decisions in his name. She was in this position of power when ambassadors came to the Tang court from the Korean kingdom of Silla, asking for aid. The king of Silla, Muyeol the Great, still ruled the strongest kingdom on the peninsula, but he had watched his neighbors, Goguryeo and Baekje, forge friendships with the Wa of Japan, and the Triple Alliance alarmed him. Wu Zetian agreed to send a Tang army of 130,000 to help Silla fight against Baekje, and in a great battle at Huang San Biol, on the border between the two kingdoms, the Baekje army was devastated. The Baekje king, Wijia, surrendered and was taken off as a prisoner, not to Silla, but to China. Wu Zetian had her eye on the Korean peninsula, and the Tang reinforcements had been a gentle probe into Korean territory. Muyeol the Great declared himself king of Silla and Baekje, but Baekje rebels were already organizing a resistance. Survivors of the Battle of Huang San Biol fled to Japan, where one of the captive king's sons already lived. He had gone to Japan some years before as a hostage and guarantor of the alliance between Japan and Baekje. There, they appealed to Prince Nako no Oe, the crown prince of the Yamato dynasty, to help them get their country back. The heavenly sovereign of Japan, the Empress Saimei, had taken the throne in 642 after her husband's death. Her son, Naka no Oe, 16 years old, was perhaps a more natural choice, but the powerful Soga clan had thrown its weight behind Saimei, who was less independent-minded than her energetic son. In 593, the Soga had managed to put a dead emperor's wife on the throne and then control it from behind the dais. Now they repeated the feat, making Saimei the second woman to occupy the throne of Japan and the second to depend on the Soga for her power. Naka no Oe was both old enough to rule and ambitious enough to resent this. He did not blame his mother, he blamed the Soga, and he began to lay plans to break their power. He found a willing ally in a senior member of the rival Nakatomi clan, Nakatomi no Kamatari. Together with a resentful younger member of the Soga clan itself, they plotted to get rid of the Soga influence by assassinating the most powerful members of its most senior family. Their primary target was Soga no Iruka, who, together with his father, Soga no Emishi, had stood behind the Empress's accession, and who, together with his father, stood to gain the most power by controlling the heavenly sovereign. The plot took some time to lay. In 645, the year Ishi, on the 12th day of the 6th month, it came to fruition. Soga no Iruka had come to court wearing his sword, as usual. He was, says the Japanese chronicle Nihongi, of a very suspicious nature, but Nakatomi no Kamatari had hired actors to put on an elaborate performance that would convince him to disarm. Soga no Iruka's suspicious nature deserted him when he most needed it. He laughed at the actors, took off the sword, and went into the Empress's presence. The 19-year-old Naka no Oe quietly ordered the guards of the gates to lock all 12 entrances to the palace. He had given the task of carrying out the assassination of Soga no Iruka to 3 other members of the conspiracy, but as they stood in the throne room listening to the business of the day being read out, it became increasingly clear that the 3 swordsmen had lost their nerve. When none of them made a move towards their victim, Naka no Oe leaped forward and struck the first blow against Soga no Iroka. Wounded, the statesman staggered to the empress and begged for mercy, but Saimei stood and left the throne room, going farther into the palace so that she could not longer hear or see what was happening. The prince's three allies, spurred into action, finished the injured man off. When his father, Emishi, heard the news, he took his own life. The conspiracy, the Ishii incident, broke the back of the Soga clan. In the resulting power vacuum, a puzzling shuffle took place. Saimei, who had turned her back, stepped down from the throne, but Naka no Oe did not rise to replace her. Instead, his uncle, the empress's younger brother, took the throne as heavenly sovereign Kotoku and ruled for 9 years. When he died, Saimei returned from her retirement and again governed as heavenly sovereign from 655 until 661. Even at her death, Naka no Oe did not rise to be heavenly sovereign. During the reigns of both his uncle and his mother, he exercised plenty of power at the Yamato court. In fact, when the Baikje survivors first appealed for help, Saimei was still on the throne, but Naka no Oe was the one who answered the call, the man who agreed to send Japanese ships to join the fight against the Silan occupiers. Before war could begin, Saimei died. Naka no Oe was now the ruler of Japan, but once again he did not take the title of heavenly sovereign. He governed, but he did not reign. It finally became clear that he believed himself to be defiled by the murder in the throne room. The bloodshed in front of the heavenly sovereign had polluted the man who spilled it. Naka no Oe had gathered his three accomplices for just this purpose, so that his hand would not be the one stained with the curse. Their failure of nerve had forced him to draw it upon himself. But even without the sacred title, Naka no Oe acted as commander-in-chief of Japan's force. The Japanese fleet sailed towards Baikje, proclaiming that Baikje Prince Buye Opang, now brought from his exile as hostage and promoted to figurehead, was the rightful king of Baikje. Just before the Japanese fleet arrived on Baikje's shores, King Muyeol of Silla died. His heir, King Munmu, took the throne and found himself facing invasion. He was particularly well fitted to fight back, though. In the war against Baikje, he had commanded a naval force for his father. In 663, the combined Baikje-Japan alliance, led by Prince Naka no Oe of Japan and Buye Opang of Baikje, met the combined Tang Silla forces in the Battle of Baikgang, fought in the same place as the Battle of Huang San Baiol 3 years before. The Tang Silla alliance was triumphant. Prince Naka no Oe returned to Japan to shore up the defenses against invasion. Buye Opang escaped into Goguryeo, and Baikje was, effectively, no more. Still reinforced by the Tang, the Silla armies now invaded Goguryeo, which fell under the assault in 668. Buye Pang was captured and, like Uija before him, was taken off to Tang China, where he disappeared from the historical record. King Munmu now ruled over the entire peninsula. With Tang help, Silla had triumphed. The Three Kingdoms period had given way to the unified Silla period, which would last until 935. But almost at once, the alliance with the Chinese dragon turned against the Silan king. Wu Zetian had intended to extend Tang rule all the way into the peninsula, not hand it over to one of the three kings. Now, she and her husband, Tang Gaozong, who had made a partial recovery, although he would suffer attacks for the rest of his life, organized the peninsula into a set of administrative districts under Tang control. They declared King Munmu of Silla the governor-general of the Tang rulership, euphoniously named the Protectorate General to pacify the East. This did not please Munmu, who suddenly found himself subordinate to the force that had made his victory possible. Searching for a solution to his dilemma, he settled on an appeal to Goguryeo's freedom fighters, the same men who had fought against him just months earlier, and who now were the last surviving resistance against Tang domination. Together, Munmu's army and the Goguryeo rebels formed a new alliance, this one against the Tang. For 5 years, the rebels fought against Tang troops in all three of the former three kingdoms. In 676, after a series of losses in the Han River Basin, Wu Zetian and Tang Gaozong decided to yield a good chunk of the Tang-controlled land to Munmu's rule, and moved the office of the Protectorate General northwest to the city of Liaodongcheng, outside the peninsula. The ways of the Tang had spread into the lands of the Turks and into the high plains of Tibet, but the Yamato remained outside of Tang power, and Manmu's resistance meant that, for a time, the unified Silla kingdom would shake itself loose from the Tang and live in freedom. Chapter 39. The Tribe of Faith. Between 622 and 642, Muhammad turns his followers into a tribe. Abu Bakr leads the tribe in the conquest of Arabia, and Umar takes them beyond the peninsula's borders. In Medina, Muhammad, leader of the Ummah, took on the job of judging the disputes of those outside the faith. Although he never claimed the titles, he found himself acting as both prophet and king in his adopted city, and soon he was forced to deal with the multiple practical difficulties pressing in upon the ideal community he had created. For one thing, unity based on belief was not easy to maintain among people who were accustomed to thinking of themselves, first and foremost, as members of particular clans and tribes. Muhammad himself had recognized distinctions among his followers. He had given the name Ansar, helpers, to the Arabs of Medina, while the Arabs who had followed him from Mecca were known as the Muhajirun, the emigrants. He had taken steps toward creating traditional bonds of kinship between himself and his close supporters. After Khadija's death, he had become betrothed to the 6-year-old daughter of Abu Bakr, although the marriage was not celebrated until the little girl grew older. His new tribe, the one based on faith, was still central to his plans for the future, but ties of blood and family were still woven through his thinking. And in other ways, the new tribe was not quite what he had expected. Muhammad's vision for Medina had been to enfold the whole city into the Ummah. His careful protection of the rights of non-Muslims had been sincere and good-hearted, but it was always meant to be temporary, lasting only until they inevitably saw the light and became followers of Allah. However, it was becoming increasingly clear that the Jews of Medina were always going to hold themselves apart. Muhammad, frustrated, was given the revelation that appears as Surah 2 in the Quran. Allah, the Surah repeats again and again, is the same God that Abraham worshipped, the same God that the Christians worship. It was Allah who gave Moses the book and followed him up with a succession of messengers, who gave Jesus, the son of Mary, clear signs and strengthened him with the Holy Spirit. Jews and Christians were wrong to insist that none shall enter paradise unless he be a Jew or a Christian. Both shall enter paradise, along with the Ummah, if they submit to Allah and do good. For Muhammad, Jews and Christians were practically already inside the Ummah, and he could not understand why they continued to hold themselves apart. Nor was he pleased with all of the Arabs who were converting. The Ummah was now the most powerful tribe in Medina. The city's schedule had been reorganized around the 5 daily prayers that Muhammad prescribed for faithful believers. Fasting and the giving of alms to the poor had been written into city law. The place of worship, the mosque, Muhammad had built was the city center. It was now politically advantageous to be Muslim, and some of the Arabs were joining the faith to get ahead. But the biggest difficulty of all was posed by Mecca. Then the apostle prepared for war, his biographer Ishaq says matter-of-factly, in pursuance of God's command to fight his enemies, whom God commanded him to fight. The revelation given in Mecca, allowing the Muslims to fight against those who have expelled them from their homes, was still in force, even though the Meccan enemies were now distant. And beginning in 623, the year after the Hijra, Muhammad began to send both helpers and emigrants out from Medina on exploratory pre-fighting missions. His first target was not Mecca itself, but rather the caravans that went between Mecca and destinations to the north, passing Medina on the way. Raiding caravans was not exactly an act of war. For centuries, Arabs had considered the caravans of other tribes to be fair game. Getting valuable food and water from passing caravans would certainly make life in Medina easier. But in preparing to raid the caravans from Mecca, which were almost all Quraysh, Muhammad was also sending a message. Loyalty to the Ummah had replaced the old tribal loyalties, and the ties of birth had been broken and supplanted with ties of faith. For several months, the exploratory missions from Medina simply involved spying, reporting, and occasionally negotiating with the caravan leaders. No one was injured until a party from Medina, spying on an enormous and rich Quraysh caravan, decided to attack and take its goods. In the scuffle, one of the Quraysh merchants was killed by an arrow shot from a Medina bow. When the expedition returned to Medina with its booty, Muhammad was furious, not because of the killing, but because it had happened during the sacred month in which fighting was forbidden. It was just this sort of disregard for ancient religious traditions that had led to the corruption and decadence of Meccan society, and he did not intend for Medina to go the same way. His anger threatened to pull the new community apart. The other members of the Ummah began to whisper that the raiding party was damned. Outside of Medina, the Quraysh spread the word that Muhammad himself had committed sacrilege. Peace was not restored until Muhammad received another revelation. Breaking the sacred month was bad, but the sins of the Meccans were much worse. Fighting in the prohibited month is a grave offence, says Surah 2, but it is graver in the sight of Allah to deny him and to drive out his followers. Tumult and oppression are worse than slaughter. Nor will they cease fighting you until they turn you back from your faith if they can. This relieved the tension in Medina, and the raiding party went back to their homes in relief. But the ripple effect of this revelation was much wider. The scope of the original permission to fight back when wronged had almost invisibly expanded. It was now permissible to fight back against those who would continue to wrong you, given a chance. The revelation gave Muhammad and his followers the justification they needed to launch a full-scale attack on a Meccan caravan. In 624, a large caravan loaded with goods from Syria passed Medina. It was led by an old enemy of Muhammad's, a man named Abu Sufyan. The path he was on led past the wells of Badr, an oasis and watering place south of Medina. Muhammad assembled 300 men, a huge force to overwhelm a single caravan, and set out for the wells to intercept the caravan there. Abu Sufyan had been expecting trouble. His scouts went out ahead of him, asking for news of any large parties on the move, and brought back intelligence of the planned Medina raid. Abu Sufyan sent a message to Mecca asking for reinforcements, and a huge army turned out, 1,000 men, with representatives from every Quraysh clan. The conflict between Muhammad's religious revolution and the old order had finally come to a head. The Quraysh army from Mecca met the smaller force from Medina at the wells of Badr on March 17, 624. Rallying his outnumbered forces, Muhammad called out that any man who was killed fighting with steadfast courage would certainly enter paradise. Driven by loyalty to Muhammad, by religious fervor, by hatred for their enemies, and by the fear of losing everything they had gained, the men from Medina turned away the larger army. Only 50 or so of the Quraysh died, but the rest were driven back. Muhammad and his men took the goods recovered from the caravan. Abu Sufyan had escaped and taken part of it back to Mecca with him, and returned to Medina in triumph. It was the first battle of Islam, a turning point in the life of the Ummah. Between 624 and 630, the fighting escalated. The Ummah in Medina drove out by force two of the Jewish tribes that refused to recognize Muhammad's authority. Major battles between the armies of Mecca and Medina took place in 625 and 627. After this second battle, the Battle of the Trench, named because the people at Medina dug a moat in front of their city to protect it from invasion, the final tribe of Jews was also exiled from the city. They had refused to take part in the battle, which was a violation of Muhammad's declaration that Jews and Arabs support each other both in peace and in war. The Battle of the Trench had itself been a draw. Cold weather had forced the attackers from Mecca to withdraw, and the Jews' non-participation probably did not alter the outcome. But the Muslims in the city were indignant over this breach of trust. The Jews were besieged in their homes and finally forced to surrender. They were given a choice: conversion to Islam or death and slavery, and chose the latter. "We will never abandon the laws of the Torah and never change it for another," Ishaq records them as saying. Muhammad appointed a judge to pronounce the sentence, a man named Sa'd, who was himself a Jewish convert to Islam. Sa'd decreed that the men be executed and the women and children made slaves. Ishaq's account is stark. Then the apostle went out to the market of Medina, which is still its market today, and dug trenches in it. Then he sent for them and struck off their heads in those trenches as they were brought out to him in batches. There were 600 or 700 in all, although some put the figure as high as 800 or 900. The new community was under attack from the outside, and the conditions of its existence had altered. There was no longer any place in Medina for neutrals. By 630, the Ummah at Medina had grown so large and powerful that Muhammad was able to assemble an army of 10,000, helpers, emigrants, and numerous soldiers from outlying tribes who either had accepted Islam or were willing to make common cause with it. At the head of this army, he marched against Mecca for the final time. Once again, he was able to offer a justification for the attack. Nomadic allies of the Quraysh had attacked nomadic allies of the Muslims. This was a hostile act against the people of the faith, and the Muslims were simply fighting back. As Muslim power had grown, the people of Mecca had begun to lean more and more towards making peace with the powerful neighbor to the north. In fact, two treaties in the previous decade had allowed Muslims to enter the city on occasion and worship at the Kaaba. Even Abu Sufyan, owner of the caravan that had been attacked at the wells of Badr, now favored a truce. When Muhammad arrived on the horizon with his army, it became perfectly clear that the truce would involve surrender. Abu Sufyan, standing on the walls, extracted a promise that the Muslims would enter the city without bloodshed. Muhammad agreed, and the gates were opened. The promise was kept. The only violence done was to the idols of various deities around the city, which were smashed and thrown down. Muhammad himself worshipped Allah at the Kaaba. He was joined by Abu Sufyan, who had agreed to convert to Islam. From this point on, Mecca was the core of Islam, the place of greatest devotion for any Muslim. Muhammad centered himself in the city, and for the next 2 years he directed various campaigns from his Meccan headquarters. More Arab tribes began to convert. His conquests reached so far down into the south that Himyar fell under his sway. The Ummah was becoming a kingdom. But Muhammad was not a king. He had given the Arabs a collective identity. What he had done for them was not unlike what Alaric had given to the Goths, or what Clovis had done for the Franks. He had taken an assortment of competing tribes and provided them with a way to think of themselves as a group. The Arab hatred for kingship meant that Alaric's role as warrior king and Clovis's role as Christian king were closed to him. Instead, he was the prophet, the creator of a new people. In 632, just before his death, he preached a farewell sermon that laid out the mixture of religious and civil regulations that shaped this new people. Allah has forbidden you to charge interest. Your women have the right to be fed and clothed in kindness. Worship Allah. Say your 5 daily prayers. Fast during the month of Ramadan. Give your wealth in charity. Perform Hajj, pilgrimage to Mecca, if you can afford to. An Arab has no superiority over a non-Arab. A white has no superiority over black. No prophet or apostle will come after me, and no new faith will be born. Not long after delivering the sermon, Muhammad grew ill and within a few days died. He left no guide to his succession, no one appointed to receive his spiritual authority, no one to act in his role as ruler of the Ummah, no one to lead further campaigns. Perhaps he had no thought that a kingdom of Muslims would exist after his death. Certainly he had no intentions of leaving a hereditary kingship of some sort over his followers. His enormous achievement had a dark side. The identity of his followers was so closely bound up with his own person that the new Islamic community immediately began to spin apart. Old tribal loyalties, freed from the almost hypnotic effect of his personality, reasserted themselves. Abu Bakr, his old friend and father of his young wife, Aisha, was chosen as his successor by a gathering of Muslims in Medina. But the election was not uncontested. Other Muslims, primarily in Mecca, wanted to appoint Ali ibn Abu Talib, Muhammad's son-in-law, who was busy washing Muhammad's body and mourning his death while the gathering was electing Abu Bakr. It is not entirely clear what Ali himself thought of the situation. According to one version of events, Ali did not seriously argue with the selection of Abu Bakr as the next leader of the Muslim people. He retreated from the controversy, considered his position, and eventually offered his support to Muhammad's friend. But other accounts suggest that he believed he should succeed his father-in-law and disputed Abu Bakr's election. Author's note: what remains unclear is whether Ali himself accepted Abu Bakr's legitimacy or whether he simply ceased to press his claims out of a desire to maintain unity among the Islamic tribes. Muslim oral traditions preserve both points of view. The former tradition is accepted by those who call themselves Sunni Muslims. They believe that the passing of the caliphate to Abu Bakr was legitimate, and that the line of caliphs who follow him is thus also legitimate. Those who disagree and support Ali as the divinely chosen successor of Muhammad were known as Shi'at Ali, the party of Ali, today Shiite Muslims. The division did not occur in Islam until considerably later, but it is rooted in the events of 632. Either way, a number of Arabs resisted Abu Bakr's leadership, with or without Ali's support. Abu Bakr reacted not as a prophet, but as a general. He divided his own followers into 11 armed groups under 11 competent commanders, and assigned each one the task of subduing, by force, the areas where resistance to his leadership was making itself known. The subjugation was successful. Abu Bakr became the sole heir of Muhammad's power, the Caliphat ar-Rasul Allah, the Caliph, representative of the message of the Prophet of God. His original title, in fact, was Caliph of the Messenger of God, acknowledging his second-place status in the line of revelation. But the strike forces did much more than subdue rebellion. Later accounts called the resistance to Abu Bakr's rule the Ridda, the apostasy, and credited Abu Bakr with holding Muhammad's conquests together. In fact, the 11 columns, under the leadership of Abu Bakr's general and right-hand man, Khalid, fanned out and expanded the Islamic kingdom by conquering nearby tribes that had not yet fallen under Muslim domination. The conquest spread. Under Abu Bakr's supervision, the rest of the peninsula fell, tribe by tribe and oasis by oasis, under the rule of the Caliph. Within a year, Arabia was united behind him. This left Abu Bakr at the head of an enormous armed camp that was not, as Medina and Mecca had been, necessarily convinced of the truth of Islam. It was, in the words of historian John Saunders, a kingdom filled with recent, tepid, and unstable converts, a powder keg with Abu Bakr sitting on the lid. Abu Bakr decided to turn its energies outwards. Medina had prospered while grappling with outside enemies. Nothing welded a people together like a war. In 633, he sent his general Khalid against the first enemy outside of the peninsula, the Persian Empire. After the long bloody war with Byzantium, Persia had been further weakened by ongoing quarrels over the crown.